Empire Podcast this week, we welcome Riz Ahmed trying to come to terms with Sylvester Stallone's departure from the Expendables franchise and chow down on much buzzed about French cannibal drama Raw. Hello, Pod. I'm not, as you've probably guessed by now, Chris Hewitt. I'm Phil Desemlin with another of my art house takeovers. Your regular host is away taking an actual holiday this week, and that's not even the code name for a new Marvel movie. It's an actual holiday. So if you're in the north of England and you spot a strange-looking man in a Captain America onesie seeing the sights, tell him we're now recording the podcast entirely in black and white. I'm joined by two colleagues of such lethal cunning. First up is Empire's Grand Fromage, the founder member of the Greasy Strangler fan club, who's currently petitioning for a green light for Greasy Strangler 2, Ooze Control. It's our very own Hootie Tootie Disco editorial director, Terry White.
That's not actually my job title.
That's not.
No. This is an awkward way to find out you don't know what I do, Phil.
Uh-oh.
And you missed out Cutie.
Yeah.
No, but I replaced Cutie with the other bit.
But shouldn't I be a Hootie Tootie Disco Cutie edit? Well.
You're saying she's not a cutie?
Yeah, thanks, Phil.
Oh.
Ooh,
okay.
So you don't know what I do and you think I'm rough.
I made you vow that you wouldn't sack me before this podcast started, so I feel like I'm sort of there's some sort of immunity
there is
going on here. You've heard him already. Our second guest is actually more of a brother of Lethal Cunning, a man so respected within the Jurassic World community, the dinosaurs call him for career advice. It's Nick Desemlian.
Hello. I just got a text from the Indominus.
Did you?
What
does he want?
A bit of a loose end.
What are you suggesting? Stage work.
Yeah, well, you'll find out.
Okay.
It'll be popping up in something soon.
All right. Right, should we kick off with a question from the readers? This one comes from @MatthewSumption, who asks, if you had to have a film character doing primary negotiations with the EU, who would you pick and why?
Wow.
You're looking at me.
I am looking at you, Terry, just because you're right there.
Okay, so, Alabama Whirly.
Who?
Wow.
From True Romance.
From True Romance, right, okay.
Yes. Not Art House enough for you, Phil?
No, I just didn't know the surname. I didn't recognise the surname.
Alabama. So everybody loves Alabama Whirly because she's an amazing combination of guile and cunning and sweetness and sexuality. And I think all of those things are super important when it comes to negotiating a great trade deal with the EU.
So Whirly is her married name. So that's come from it's Clarence Whirly, isn't it? So
yes.
They get married. What's her surname before?
That's a really good question.
I really want to know that now.
Do we ever find out?
I'm not sure.
I'm not sure either.
I'm going to look it up.
Look it up.
Keep talking.
Yeah. So I think she's one of my favourite film characters of all time. And I just kept thinking, when you posted this question, I kept thinking about that scene with her and James and Gandolfini, where she essentially, you know, kills him, spoiler alert for anybody who hasn't seen True Romance. And she displays all of her best character traits in that very scene. Basically, she is sweet, she is charming, she tries to trick him, and then when that kind of doesn't work, she resorts to blow-torching him in the face with hairspray and a lighter, smashing a toilet cistern over his head, putting a corkscrew in his foot, and then shooting him.
Yes.
Do you think I'm not advocating violence.
I never want to negotiate anything with you.
I have a salary thing,
don't worry about that meeting we got. Don't worry. It's fine.
I think some of those skills may come in handy at some point in political negotiations.
That's a good answer.
Whitman.
Oh,
she's Alabama Whitman.
That's amazing.
I'm not sure that's ever said in the film, but there we go.
I don't think it is said in the film. I never remember that being part of the script.
There we go. Bombshell. I'm gonna throw Michael Corleone into the mix just because he's ice cold. And famously in Godfather Part 2, he's negotiating with a Nevada senator, and he says the great line, my offer is this, nothing.
Ooh.
I want to say that to someone.
Yeah.
But I haven't had an opportunity, and I've been too scared. But it's a good line, just like, you can't have anything. Deal with it.
And if you negotiate with your brother, imagine that.
With me?
With your actual brother, and he crossed you.
Yeah. Okay, all right, well, next time we negotiate, watch out. Jerry Maguire, show me the money. That's quite a bold tactic. Just yell that at people.
I like that. What about the negotiator?
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm struggling to remember who that was.
they're both negotiators.
Right, Kevin Spacey.
So Samuel L. Jackson is the former negotiator who's gone rogue, and Kevin Spacey is Chris Sabian.
Right.
It's a good character name, that.
Gosh, good memory.
He comes in and negotiates with the negotiator.
Okay.
So you could get them both in.
Yeah, I like that.
If you negotiate with a negotiator, are you like an Uber negotiator? Not a negotiator who negotiates Ubers, but like some grand dam of negotiators. Because how would you negotiate with a negotiator otherwise?
Yeah. You should get a kind of editorial director style made up. Made up. Sorry, Phil.
Managing editor.
That also isn't my job title.
Editor-in-chief.
Thank you. Oh, three times, people. Three times it took.
So, negotiator-in-chief.
Yes.
That should be Chris Sabian's title. I don't know. I'm thinking about other just famously sort of hard-ass people. So, Alec Baldwin in Glengarry Glen Ross. Always be closing.
Yep.
ABC. EU is an acronym too. So, I don't know. ABC-EU. It's almost the alphabet. I don't know where I'm going with this. If anyone wants to take over.
What about Ray Winston in Scum? I'm worried that all of mine involve violence.
You're just so.
There isn't much nuance to my negotiation skills. Here's a sock full of snooker balls.
Yeah.
I'm not advocating violence, people. It would be bad in a political situation.
Well, if we're talking peaceful negotiations, the wolf from Pulp Fiction he just strikes me as a guy who would just come in and sort it out. Be very smooth. There's a good Portlandia skit where the wolf from Pulp Fiction comes and just at the end of a big dinner and comes and sorts the bill out, so he tells everyone exactly what they have to pay.
Yeah.
Which,
that is a great sketch.
Yeah.
That is a great sketch. Do you not feel the wolf's lost some of his kind of cachet since
the adverts.
The adverts.
What was he advertising? Something rubbish.
Yes. I don't know if we can. Not even the doors.
Well. Yes, I do agree that he shouldn't have done that. Bad wolf.
Bad wolf.
So I don't know. The EU aspect, I don't really have an answer for. A movie character that knows the ins and outs of Europe. Apart from I wouldn't get the French soldiers from Monty Python and the Holy Grail in. So I think they'd make everything worse. Just insult people.
Phil, who would you get?
I think you'd be wanting someone with legal skills. So I don't know. I wonder what would happen if Sean Penn's character from Carlito's Way got involved.
Wow.
Got the gift of the gab. Mm-hmm. And after hours connects, but I think that would probably spiral pretty fast.
I'm pretty sure his hairstyle contravenes some EU regulations.
Unquestionably.
I think he'd be shut down just for that.
Yeah. Would Spock do the job, do we think?
Spock. Yeah. I don't know. Would he? He's very calm.
Yeah.
He has that in his favour. I think he'd be a bit confused by the whole situation, wouldn't he?
Yeah.
His stance on Brexit. What do you think, Terry?
What about?
About Spock. About Spock and Brexit.
I think Spock isn't hard enough.
Why do you need to be so sort of muscled up and ready to
I don't know, Phil. That's a good question, one I shall take to therapy. But I think it helps. I think we are genuinely in danger of getting completely done over.
So we need someone psychotic.
Yeah. So I think the kind of more wild-eyed, I think intimidation counts for a lot in this life. And I think Theresa May's may not be doing the job. Although she's pretty terrifying, I have to say. She's as tough women go.
Okay,
she's right up there with Thatcher.
You give me an idea. Gary Busey in drag from Under Siege.
Wow.
He's wild-eyed. He's wearing a dress. He doesn't know a lot about Europe, but
no.
I think he'd get the job done.
That is good.
That's my answer.
That's good. Right, this is weird, right? What about Kez?
What?
The bird.
The bird.
Right? Just think about it for a minute, right?
Yeah.
So Kez kind of, you know, Billy Casper became a completely different, better person, arguably, because Kez came into his life. So maybe in terms of changing hearts and minds, transforming people, you know, really getting, making these negotiations have heart and soul and emotion.
Yeah.
And making people be better versions of themselves.
Okay.
Maybe the bird from Kez.
I think Kez could, you've converted me, I think Kez could solve Europe and the world, possibly.
Yeah.
He could fly to the Middle East straight afterwards. Just solve that.
President Kez.
Kez for president of the world. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's the answer, right?
Kez. We're sending a Kestrel to the negotiations. Deal with that, the EU. Right, should we have some hot movie news? Nick, I think you've got something
piping hot
from the Expendables averse.
It's a really today is a really sad day for fans of Barney Ross, both of them. Also fans of Lee Christmas, Conrad Stonebanks, Toll Road and Hail Caesar, all actual character names from the Expendables franchise.
Who played Toll Road?
Oof, you're testing.
Do you remember? It wasn't Dolph.
We talked about this recently on the podcast. I think we talk
about this every week on the podcast. The cast list of the Expendables.
Yeah, my mind has gone blank. I feel like it's Terry Crews, but it might not be.
Okay. Toll Road.
Maybe he's Hail Caesar. Randy Couture, I think, actually.
Right.
But, so Stallone is saying he's not coming back for a fourth one. Arnold Schwarzenegger, a.k.a. Trench Mauser, has now weighed in. He said he's not going to come back unless Stallone does it.
Okay.
So can the franchise afford to lose Barney and the Trench and continue? There's enough of them to frankly go on. You know, there's about 40 people in that series, so it feels like it could probably go on. But Stallone is kind of the driving force, isn't he?
This is one of those bits of news where you're like, I didn't know that was still a thing, a bit. Like, I wasn't really aware that the Expendables was sort of a going concern. So, and I thought it was very much Sly Stallone's baby. So without him, I'm not wholly sure kind of what you're left with.
My favourite detail is that he's withdrawn over creative disputes. Creative disputes. Can we all just let that sink in for a moment? Expendables 4, creative disputes.
I think someone said there should be a plot. And he's like, no, it's a plot. No room for plot. Too many guns. We ain't got room for plot. I mean, the third one arguably was the best, which is not saying much. It's like saying this third pigeon I saw today is the best pigeon. But it's... I don't know where that pigeon allegory was going. But the third one was okay, right? It was slightly better than the other two. I wrote the review and I can't remember much about it now, but I remember Harrison Ford was in a plane yelling and Wesley Snipes was running around on top of a train.
The train scene at the beginning had something.
And Mel Gibson was the villain. It had something to it that the other two didn't.
Mel Gibson had more of a sense of fun. Yes. They blew up a lot of stuff, I remember that. Apparently, though, in the creative differences thing, that Sly and RV Lerner, the producer, agreed on 95% of things.
So what's the 5%?
The plot, probably.
Yeah.
The plot issue was a sticking point.
I think one of the reports said it was certain qualitative elements. I'm like, that's just what an amazing way to describe it.
Qualitative
I don't even know what that means.
No,
yeah. I don't know. Maybe one of the character names wasn't silly enough for Stallone.
Yeah.
And he was just... Yeah, it was a deal-breaker for him.
But they can't... I mean, there can't be an Expendables without Sly.
Well, I was going to say, it just feels like... It feels like, yeah. It feels like the guy driving the car sort of getting out and just throwing himself into the road. So I just don't know where this thing goes now.
Yeah, I... I don't know. I could leave it to be honest. If this is the end of the Toll Road, I could handle that.
What else is news this week?
So there's news on Dune. Obviously, Denis Villeneuve, who is doing Blade Runner 2047, is next up for him is an adaptation of Dune by Frank Herbert, which is one of the ultimate sci-fi novels. It's going to be a tough one. It's obviously been attempted before. David Lynch had a go. Not everybody loved that, to put it mildly. And there's been a TV series, I think about 10 years ago, which didn't get great reviews either. So this is a really tough challenge to try and make this into a film. I think the book is 900 pages.
Yeah.
And it's just a monster. And it's got people riding giant worms. Are you a fan of Dune?
I am. But aren't they saying it's going to be a franchise rather than a single film? Or... That's kind of the impression, which may help with the 900 pages of source material.
Definitely. I didn't know that. Okay. It's very dense stuff, so that would help if it's a franchise. But is there like an appetite for a Dune franchise? I don't know.
No. Sorry, was that a rhetorical question?
But for me, the exciting thing is, we should say who the writer is, by the way, because that's the whole point of the story. It's Eric Roth, who...
He's got pedigree, hasn't he? I mean, he did... Forrest Gump, Munich. He's done some good stuff.
Yeah. His last sci-fi film I didn't know this off the top of my head. I looked it up. But his last sci-fi film was The Postman.
Ah.
Kevin Costner film. So he hasn't got pedigree in sci-fi. But you're right. He's done a lot of good films. But the main reason I'm excited is the director. I just think Villeneuve is like possibly the most exciting director working today. I can't wait for Blade Runner. I thought Sicario was brilliant. So I'm kind of trusting him.
Yeah. He is a great director. Mm. And one that we've been excited about for ages. And if anyone can do it, those guys seem like they might be able to, potentially. Who knows?
Yeah, if anyone can do Giant Worms.
Yeah. Another director that I love and excited about, Pablo Larraín, who did Jackie earlier this year, and somehow has made another movie in short order, Neruda, which is out, I think, this week. We're going to talk about it later. He is going to be directing a film called The True American, and he's got Tom Hardy playing the sort of co-lead for that one. This is a film that was, I think, one that Catherine Bigelow was gonna do back in 2014 with Tom Hardy, but she stepped away. And Pablo Larraín, the Chilean director, is going to sort of take over. It's based on a book called Murder and Mercy in Texas, and it's a small, in the shadow of 9/11, I guess, a lesser known kind of terrorist atrocity by an American terrorist known as Mark Stroman, who I believe will be the Tom Hardy part, who went into a Dallas mini mart just after 9/11 and shot some people, including a guy from Bangladesh. The Bangladeshi man, Rasuddin Bian, I think is pronounced, potentially, he basically recovered and went down to find Mark Stroman on death row and basically reconcile with him, try and find forgiveness. So I expect it's going to be sort of part terrorist thriller and part kind of human drama, this one. And Pablo Larraín, I think it's just exciting for him to be making a movie in America, because I think he's incredibly talented, and love to see him do more Hollywoody stuff, I guess, in the way that Denis Villeneuve has done. Mm. Is it Denis or Dennis?
Denis.
I'm
going to say Denis.
I'm going to say Dennis.
Go Dennis.
Den. I think he wouldn't mind me calling him Den.
I don't think he'd have any problem with that whatsoever. What else do we have?
We have, Ridley Scott, who is obviously just about to come back with Alien Covenant, which we are very excited about here at Empire. He has something else planned with Fox, which is going to be based on the Battle of Britain, the actual Battle of Britain. And which obviously it's the World War II historical story. That's all the courageous British underdogs overcome the Nazis.
Yes.
And this promises, you'd think, to be a historical drama of real scale, hopefully an epic. And it's got a new kind of new-ish UK writer, Matthew Orton, who wrote Operation Finale, who is penning it along with him, and Matt Charman, who did Bridge of Spies, is exec producing the film. So some really great names attached to it, and, you know, anything... I basically say anything Ridley Scott touches,
yes,
turns into a really good movie. I think that's how the saying goes.
Except Moses.
You haven't seen The Counselor, Terry.
I like The Counselor.
Most of the things Ridley Scott does turns into really good films.
Yes.
Some of them do. Yeah, I mean, he's done war kind of films before, Black Hawk Down, obviously, and Kingdom of Heaven, and
The Duelist.
Going right back to the beginning of The Duelist, which is Napoleonic Wars, isn't it? But he's not done World War II, and he's not really done a big epic, which I'm guessing this is going to be...
You've got to imagine the scale will be phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal. And you know, we've got Dunkirk coming out this summer, obviously.
It's not a war movie.
Which is not a war movie. I was reading this morning. It's not a war movie.
What is it?
But it's a film about war.
What is that? What's the... What?
I added that last bit. But
that was good.
Thank you. It's not a war film.
It's a survival, film.
About
surviving
war.
War.
Combat.
Yes.
It's a combat film. Don't call it a war movie anywhere near Christopher Nolan. He won't like that. Okay. But no, there's some really exciting, kind of movies sort of set around World War II. And I hope that Peter Jackson finally makes his Dam Busters film, because I'm still waiting for that.
Is that going to happen? He's built the planes, hasn't he? He's built the dams.
I think he's written a script with Stephen Fry, which happened like five...
Yeah, that was ages ago.
I do wonder what Peter Jackson's up to. He's just in shell-shocked from The Hobbit, I think. And
yeah.
I don't know. I hope he's okay. And I hope he comes back and makes some more films. But, yeah, I don't know. My question is, how is Ridley Scott going to fit this into the... Didn't he just announce five more Alien films? Or
plus, he's got the... he's got the all the money in the world ransom movie.
Yes, the Getty kidnapping.
About the Getty kidnapping, yep. Which is his next, I think his next film.
It is, yes.
This man, it's incredible. Like, he's going to be 80 in November.
It is astonishing. At this stage in his life to have such an output and still such, because this has long been, I was reading that this has long been a passion of his and something he's wanted to do in terms of this Battle of Britain story. And to have that still, that drive and that passion, because making films is fairly knackering.
It's quite stressful and tiring, right?
As you enter that kind of decade of your life. So it's kind of remarkable, really, that his output. And, you know, even just with Covenant, everything, we've been lucky enough to see a bit of footage, and it looks really, really, really great. And to still be producing films of that quality at this speed, I think, is kind of astonishing.
Yeah, it is astonishing. As a group of people that high-five each other when they manage to successfully leave the house and get to work every day, we stand in awe at Ridley's abilities to make films as quickly and efficiently and on such scale.
Yeah, I haven't found time to Google all of his projects. He's making them faster than I can Google them. So
I spoke to someone that was working on Alien Covenant last night, and they were saying that he was giving them direction. I said, "Look, what's your first bit of direction you got from Ridley?" And they were like, he basically just drew the setup there and then on a piece of paper and just gave it to me and said, "This is what I want you to do." He's very visual, so I think the idea of him making a big war epic is pretty exciting. I quite like that to happen. Have you seen the other Battle of Britain film with Michael Caine and everyone else that was acting at that time?
No.
Is that The Longest Day?
No, it's called there's the Battle of Britain.
It's called The Battle of Britain. Well,
but it's not a war movie.
It was a long day, though.
It wasn't a war movie.
This is a long day.
This is starting to feel like the longest day.
Right. So, what else do we have?
Another director, quickly. Sam Mendes is in talks to adapt a graphic novel, which is called My Favorite Thing Is Monsters. And the sub-editor pedant inside me wants that to be My Favourite Thing. No, it's fine as it is.
Okay.
I was going to change it to R.
Oh, I knew you were going to do that.
But no, that doesn't work. So, no, they got it right.
So it has to be My Favourite Things. It'd have to be plural, right?
I know, you're right. I know that now. So anyway, so what's interesting-ish, more interesting than that last point, is that it's kind of got a bit of a... It's got some sort of connections to... The Road to Perdition, which was Sam Mendes' film, which was also set in Chicago and was based on a graphic novel. That's it.
Yeah.
This one is based on a fictional graphic diary of a 10-year-old girl called Karen, who is trying to solve the murder of her upstairs neighbour. And apparently it's very, very good. And dark and weird and sort of flashbacks to World War II era.
Yeah.
And I really want to read it, having read a synopsis.
Yeah, I had the exact same thing, because this kind of surprised me with him. And when I and I actually on Empire Online read this story, and my immediate thing was, oh God, I have to go and buy this graphic novel. It sounds amazing.
I thought that too. Yeah,
absolutely amazing, but not necessarily like the thing you'd expect Sam Mendes to do, kind of hurtling out of Bond. So I think this is really, really exciting. Nick, we could buy the book between us and share it.
Can we get an office copy of this book?
Yeah, this sounds like a really elaborate plug for this book, doesn't it?
Well,
would like to send it to us.
I just tried to buy it. I'm not sure. Am I allowed to say the website that I tried to buy it through? But it's not available either here or in America.
Oh,
so okay. I don't know how to get it. So if you're listening, monsters.
What?
Singular.
Send me a copy. Okay, I'll stop talking. And then I just wanted to throw the Dumbo news. I know everyone is excited about Dumbo. Tim Burton's Dumbo, and it's what's really exciting is Michael Keaton is going to be in it as the villain.
What villain?
I don't know.
Oh, it just looks like I misread the whole Dumbo movie. There wasn't.
They're adding quite a lot of stuff, and I think he plays the owner of the circus.
Right.
Yeah, I think doesn't he buy the circus and essentially wants to exploit Dumbo. I mean, there's always an animal exploitation villain in all kind of. animal narratives, right?
Yep.
As far as I'm aware.
Yep.
Yep.
101 Dalmatians.
War Horse.
Lassie.
Not a war film.
Oh,
not
is
a horse.
Is there bad people in Lassie?
Always. They're mostly down the well.
I was going to say, I'm down the well.
What's that, Lassie?
Yeah, War Horse is a horse about a war.
Is there ever an episode of Lassie where the family learn to speak Lassie?
Well,
well, it's just people barking at each other.
No, the dog... Well, I don't know. The dog... In every episode, the dog communicates some important piece of information to members of the family who seem to understand it naturally. So I'm just wondering if there was an origin for that, if there's a...
Doesn't it mean there's someone stuck down a well in every episode?
Yeah.
I think that's pretty much...
An arrival-style origin story where
limited.
They learn the language.
Have you ever tried to talk to a dog?
Yeah. Yeah.
I did what... Yeah. I'm saying, right,
that's
I'm
not
serious.
That weird, though, is it?
No, but I had a thing where I don't really like animals, but I thought, I wonder if I try and speak to it... and kind of move my head and intonate in the right way, then it kind of will start to converse with me, just as kind of a social experiment.
Yeah.
And it totally worked.
Wow. Did it?
Wow. Yeah.
Are you now in touch on
so
a regular
I'm now
basis?
In touch with dogs.
All dogs.
What if you don't
all
like
dogs.
Animals?
I don't know.
You're the villain in Tim Burton's Dumbo movie.
I'm the villain in this movie.
Yeah, no, the movie of this podcast. But yeah, some people have noted that this is kind of turning into a Batman Returns reunion because it's got Michael Keaton and Danny DeVito. So we just need Michelle Pfeiffer, Christopher Walken. And I've got an amazing Christopher Walken fact to share because I met Christopher Walken and... for some reason, we start talking about elephants. It turned out that he used to work in a circus when he was very young. And his job at the circus was to shave the elephants. And I think he was only about 17 or 18. And he told me that the way to shave an elephant is to use fire because their hair is too tough to use.
Shave them where?
It's their faces. They get hairy faces.
Why don't you just let them be hairy? Why? What is this societal expectation of smooth-faced elephants?
Sadly, the interview was wrapped up almost immediately. But no, that stuck in my mind, that the image of Christopher Walken burning
with
elephants' facial hair. And that's the thing that he did for a job.
Poor
so
elephants.
He should be in Dumbo. Like, this is... Yeah.
I'm not sure about that because as he walks around with a flamethrower on set.
Petter, if you're listening.
Yeah. This has not been too good for violence or animals so far.
Disregard all of that if you're near an elephant in the future.
And I've got one more, which is Ben Wheatley's Freak Shift. Here's another man that does not hang around. He's bash right into the next project, which is just signed up Armie Hammer. Obviously, one of his Free Fire cast. And she's joining Alicia Vikander in a film in which people, cops, hunt nighttime monsters.
Ben Wheatley's description of this film is amazing. He was asked about it recently, and his description of it was, women with shotguns fighting giant crabs.
Oh.
Well, now, I'm in. You're in, aren't you?
That's not a word wasted there.
That is like my porn.
Women with shotguns fighting giant crabs. If the giant crabs also had shotguns, I'd be marginally more excited, but I'm already on board. That sounds amazing, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes,
it does. Yes,
it does. Yeah. Armie Hammer has joined it.
Hmm?
Armie Hammer.
Yeah, Armie Hammer's joined it.
Okay.
But because I think he's her... I kind of love this because she's the lead and I think he's her love interest.
Hmm.
Which I think is a...
Or is he the crab monster?
Yeah. What was her love interest?
No.
No inter-woman crab relationships
all right,
occurred during the making of this film.
Fair enough. Okay. Well, I hope he gets a shotgun. Armie Hammer, he was on the podcast recently and he's a nice guy. He's a good guy. So, good news.
Good news all round. Right. Time for this week's guest. Riz Ahmed first announced himself in Michael Winterbottom's The Road to Guantanamo and Aaron Creevy's ace London thriller Shifty. Since then, he's made Rubber Dinghy Rapids famous in Four Lions, Crossed the Atlantic with The Night Of and Nightcrawler, and The Galaxy in Rogue One. We sent John Nugent to talk to him about his latest film, City of Tiny Lights.
We're thrilled to welcome to the Empire podcast, Riz Ahmed. How are you doing, sir?
I'm good, man. How are you?
Yeah, very good. Very good. We are here to talk about City of Tiny Lights. How would you describe it? Is it sort of a London film noir? Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think so. It's a film noir set in contemporary London. And so it's a kind of mix of that really familiar old, you know, LA Confidential, you know, Long Good Friday, Chinatown kind of private detective movie. Mixed with, you know, contemporary London and what that looks like and sounds like. And so it's an interesting kind of combination. And One other thing I would say is this kind of how it departs from the traditional film noir is that it's actually got quite a lot of heart to it. You know, traditionally noirs are about kind of, you know, a world, it's an amoral world. Whereas this is actually one about people in search of their moral compass, you know.
You mentioned a few films there. Is there any like specific film noir classic movies you watched for inspiration before making
them? I actually don't do that.
No?
Yeah, I don't really kind of, once I try and watch as many films as I can when I'm not working, but then when someone kind of offers me a role for something, I actually don't, well, part of my research is never really watching other movies that are similar.
Yeah.
It may sometimes be watching documentaries so I can learn about stuff and doing reading and interviewing people, but I don't really do that because I kind of feel like it makes me quite self-aware and I'm thinking about the end result and where it will sit on the shelf in people's minds, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Oh, this film will end up something a little bit like half this and half that. And I feel like it's really can be a bit toxic to think about the end result. You've got to kind of just commit to the process of it and not try and control how it comes out. And that's true in each scene that you approach as well. If you try and plan out the outcome, I think it can be weird things happen.
Yeah. I mean, and obviously you are a Londoner yourself and having worked recently in like New York and LA and Las Vegas and obviously a galaxy far away, what's it like being back on home turf?
You know, it was kind of amazing because I was filming the night of for like 8 months straight in New York, and then I came home homesick and used to live with my brother and he just moved out, and I was kind of just at home like, and I was just itching to jump into something, and I wanted to kind of just reconnect to my city, you know, and this was the perfect opportunity. We've been talking about doing it for a long time, and we're coming to the end of our shoot for the night of. I just committed and said, yeah, you know, as soon as I get back, let's just jump in.
Yeah.
And but that was kind of a crazy thing to do because I was fucking shattered and I was just dead from that, from all this gym work, like, and just such an intense shoot. And I came back and I thought, well, you know, summer in London, maybe won't be that bad. And then they were like, yeah, we're going to be using rain machines constantly. The whole thing's a night shoot, 6 weeks of nights, never done that before. And we're going to be chain smoking throughout the whole thing.
Yeah.
It fucked me up. I was like, yeah, let me just summer in London, I'll reconnect to my city. He's like, nah. It was intense.
You're not a smoker then? Because I mean, you're pretty much smoking in every scene. It's like the classic film noir thing of are you a smoker at all?
I'm not a smoker. I'm almost slightly allergic to cigarette smoke.
Wow.
Yeah, it will like, it does weird things to me.
Yeah.
Like, and so I, no exaggeration, I had a fever.
Oh God.
For 3 weeks straight.
Wow.
It was so intense.
From smoking?
From everything. It was like coming off the back of the night off, going straight into a really an intense shoot when you're in every scene, smoking in every scene, under a rain machine, filming until 5 a.m.
Yeah.
So when you put it all together, it's like, I was just fucked. This whole shoot, I was just fucked. That's really how I would sum it up.
Yeah.
But I loved it, man.
Yeah.
I loved it. I loved kind of just being on home turf and telling this story. I was passionate about telling it. You know, when you're growing up, you want to be a superhero. You want to be a private detective. Yeah. I got to be a private detective and do it my own way and in this time and place. And yeah, so it was challenging, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
It wasn't like just a lovely walk through like London parks. but I enjoyed it.
You're quite a recognisable face in London these days. Was there any sort of, shall we say, memorable encounters with Londoners while you're shooting? Because there's a lot of on-location shooting, right? I mean, it's all on London streets.
Well, more than that, I was just kind of bumping into people I knew.
Right, oh, right.
Yeah, it was that. It was like one of those weird ones.
Yeah.
Where it was like, what, where you been? I haven't seen you since school.
Oh, amazing.
And like when you're filming in West London or like in Brixton, it'd be like, people I knew from music. It was just random. It was literally, it couldn't have been more of a homecoming.
Yeah.
And they were like, yeah, cool. Dude, why you stood under a rain machine? Like, I don't know, man. Ask the director. I'm not going to let that go, am I?
No.
I'm just so pissed about that still.
I know, you never had an umbrella either. I mean,
well, exactly.
Or a raincoat.
Yeah, or even a hood.
Yeah.
Like, dude, you live in England.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's all good. It's all good.
Can we just talk about The Night Of for a little bit? Because that was, I mean, for a lot of people in the Empire office, myself included, that was maybe the best TV show of the last year.
Wow, thank you so much.
How was that experience? Because it was kind of fraught, right? It took a little while to make it to the screen.
Yeah, it wasn't. That wasn't a walk in the park either. Yeah, yeah. You're spotting a pattern here, aren't you? It's like, yeah, I mean, that was tricky, obviously, because, I mean, we shot the pilot in 2012.
Wow.
So episode one, that's me at like age 27 or something.
Okay, yeah.
And then, yeah, we shot the pilot. Everyone was ready to. It was like they were, yeah, let's go, let's do the show. And then the network didn't pick it up. And then they did pick it up, but then James Gandolfini passed away.
Right.
He was originally playing John Turturro's role, right. And we'd shot a couple of scenes with him. So it was only a couple of small scenes, but it was like, who are you going to get to fill those shoes?
Yeah.
And then Robert De Niro said he'd do it, like, you know, 9 months later or 8 months later or something. And then he didn't do it, and then he was here to do something else, and then it was like, no, it's definitely not going to be made now. And then all of a sudden it was a real roller coaster.
Yeah.
And then John Turturro stepped in and just smashed it. So the whole thing was like, as you said, it wasn't a smooth ride. And then the shoot itself was very challenging because of, I mean, when we were filming the pilot in 2012, Hurricane Sandy happened.
Oh, right, yeah.
Then when we were filming the series in 2014, 2015, the Superstorm Blizzard happened where they shut down the city.
Yeah.
People put their back out. Like, you know, it was just crazy. I was spending 3 hours at the gym every day in between, like, massive shooting. It was intense. But I think, again, with that, I think I'm learning that, you know, people withstand a lot,
yeah,
and get through it if they really believe in the story.
And I mean, obviously, it was just a limited series. It was a mini series. But has there been any conversation whatsoever about?
I think there are some. More? I've heard some kind of things in passing about the possibility of a second series. If there is a second series, I imagine it won't have anything to do with my character, because yeah. I feel like his journey is yeah. complete, at least cinematically, you know. And yeah. it's like, I kind of love the idea that it was like a special one-off thing. You get to know this guy and his life, and then we move on.
Yeah. You also were in an amazing American TV show, The OA, for Netflix, which is one of those kind of water cooler TV shows that kind of, it just generated this buzz all of its own. I mean, that was a smaller role, but that is getting a second series. Are we going to see you in that?
It is getting a second series. I shouldn't really say anything about that, and I'm not sure if you'll see me in it. But I wanted to work with, I just want to work with amazing people.
Mm-hmm.
And Britt Marling and Zal Batmanglij, who wrote that show, and Zal directed it, and Britt starred in it. They're amazing people.
Yeah.
Like, working with really clever, creative, bold people, I think just like inspires you, just ups your game. So they asked me to come and do something. I was like, yeah, you know.
Yeah.
But I thought it was just such a bold show. It was mad, wasn't it?
It was out there. It was out there.
Crazy.
Yeah.
It was like, I was pausing it sometimes going, what?
Yeah, yeah.
But like in a good way, like I had to binge the whole thing.
Yeah.
Because it's crazy, you know, you've never seen anything like that, which is, I'd love to be part of projects like that. I'd love to just kind of do things that are kind of like different, you know? Yeah.
It would be remiss of me not to mention Star Wars. Obviously, we are Empire. Now that sort of dust has settled on Rogue One, how does it feel knowing you're part of the Star Wars universe forever?
I mean, I just feel really lucky and privileged to have been kind of allowed into that family. Yeah, to be honest, it feels like, I don't know, it feels like Bodhi needs a prequel.
Yeah.
Yeah, it feels like that, don't you think?
An origin story, yeah.
Yeah, I think maybe, or like, yeah, a three-part origin story.
Okay. A trilogy.
I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's my feeling on the matter. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Well, yeah, Lucasfilm are listening, obviously. So
yeah, exactly. It better be.
Yeah. I mean, it is crazy because, I mean, you're Lego now. You are a Lego figurine.
Yeah.
Have you got your Lego?
I don't have that Lego.
I mean, you should have that.
I should have that. You should be my agent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They didn't like send it to you for approval or anything.
They were the Lego. Yeah. The Lego is very close likeness.
Okay.
Yeah. So yeah. They nailed that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But they did send me some of the other toys, and I was like, "What? That's cool. That's funny."
I saw somewhere that you sent. Was it 14 audition tapes or 14 of the takes of the same audition tape to Gareth Edwards?
Yeah, I kind of get a bit obsessive about stuff in general.
Yeah.
So if we don't have the kind of the ticking clock of being on a film set, you get I just keep going. Yeah, I'll just keep recording them and just keep sending them. I'll just keep going. It stops even being about what the hell he's going to think. Because you know about from the third email, he's going to think you're insane.
Yeah.
So it's just something you can't let go of. And I just have to keep doing it. It's quite weird. And I just keep finding like new things. And how about if I do like this and do like that? What if he's like this? Okay, what if he's different like that? And I'm just obsessive and weird. Basically, I just did another set of, got asked to put myself on tape for another thing that I'm doing this summer, and I recorded 50 auditions for it.
Wow.
Yeah, but I don't think it's helpful. I definitely end up finding stuff when you do that. So I did that. But then you have to do the thing of like picking three. Right. And that takes a week, man.
Yeah.
So this is a bad use of time.
So is it like offering options then? Is it?
Yeah,
like,
I want to do that.
Yeah,
I always want to do like give people options. Okay. I always want to like, and for myself as well, I want to kind of explore and see and like push myself to think of things totally differently, question every assumption. And there's like this version of the character, and then there's this completely different version of the character turned on its head, and there's this.
Yeah,
that's what I want to do. Yeah.
Hey Riz, thanks so much for your time.
No, I appreciate it.
Come back anytime.
Thank you, man.
Thanks.
Right, movie reviews time. Let's start with the most exciting movie of the week. Unless you're under the age of 5 years old and you've got Peppa Pig, My First Cinema Experience, circled in your diary, it's Raw from French director Julia Ducournau. I think I've said that badly as well. Terry, hit us. How good is this film?
I love this film. 4-star film. I first saw it a few months ago and it completely blew me away. So Raw is the story of a 16-year-old student, Justine, who's been raised a strict vegetarian. She goes to veterinary college or school, where her sister also attends. And as part of a hazing ritual, she eats raw rabbit's kidneys. This sends her into a spiral of meat eating / cannibalism.
A meat frenzy.
A meat frenzy. So it's, I was describing it to somebody the other day and I was like, well, it's a French-Belgian feminist cannibal teenage coming of age horror film, kind of, essentially. But it's also a familial story about two sisters. At the heart of it, it's a kind of family drama. But it's famous because during Toronto, which is where it premiered, people were reported to be fainting, throwing up, ambulances were called. It's, yes, it's gory, but it's not that horrific for a start. It's incredibly well made. The lead is, she is absolutely incredible. I'm going to do what you just did, Garance Marillier.
That was,
and I think if you say it up at the end, then it sounds a little bit more French. She is incredible. She's very magnetic. Her and the director, I think, did a short together previously, and they clearly have a shorthand between them because her performance is incredible. She absolutely holds the film, and she is a real, I think, kind of star of the future. It's very visceral, it's very bloody, but it's also a very human story at the heart of it. And I have now seen it twice, as people on the podcast may be getting used to. I watch films repeatedly when they connect with me in some way. And I would absolutely recommend that everybody goes to see this film. It's one of the more original horror films. We're in a good time for horror if you think about Get Out, but it's definitely one of the most original horror films that I've seen in recent years. And it's certainly not kind of a, I think even horror may not be accurately describing it as a genre. It's a fantastic film, and I would heartily recommend everybody run to their local cinema this weekend.
That stuff about the Toronto faintings has been like dominated the press for this film pretty early on.
It has.
And I think the director's been trying to run away from it a bit.
She has. I think it's irritating. I do find it irritating because, and I get we're journalists, people like a little hook to hang something on. Mm. But it kind of, to me, it undermines the film because it isn't a shock gore fest. That's not what it is at all. It's an incredibly well told story. It is a story about sisterhood and rivalry and, you know, and family. That's what's essentially at the heart of it. And it's a coming of age story. You are following this girl as she's on the brink of womanhood, essentially, and discovering who she is. And in many ways, this cannibalism is kind of a metaphor for that and for her discovering her appetites, both sexual and in every other way. So I think it's a really, really fascinating, textured film. And I think the headlines are kind of, you know, this always happens. But if I was the director, I'd be doing the exact same thing because it's kind of nonsense. Sorry, I just started shouting there.
Amen. And when we gave that four stars.
A very well-deserved 4 stars. Mm.
Fantastic. Also out this week is Pete Travis's City of Tiny Lights, which is the film that Riz Ahmed is obviously starring in. And he's great. I thought the film itself was a bit so-so. They've done something kind of interesting with it in that they've taken all of the clothing of a kind of classic American noir and applied it to a mostly nocturnal kind of West London cityscape in which Riz Ahmed plays this basically private eye who encounters all of the kind of low-life-ery that, you know, private eyes have to sort of spend their time with. He holds the screen throughout and it's very much his film. He's sort of the center point of all of it, really. But where I don't think it works quite so well is it flashes back across two timelines. So you see Riz Ahmed picking up this case, an escort lady's been disappeared and he has to go and find out, and tied into that is some stuff that's happened in his own past. So the film kind of keeps jolting back and forth between these two separate timelines, and Billy Piper plays his kind of sort of lost love, I guess, and she's very good too, and the two of them have good chemistry. But I just found that the noirishness of it just kind of wore a bit thin after a while. All of the tropes we're kind of used to seeing from that genre just felt a little bit stale, and the plot itself just fizzled out a bit for me. So that one was only 2 stars for City of Tiny Lights.
Do you know what I love most about everything you just said?
What's that?
The words escort lady.
I'm so sorry I said that.
The most lovely Phil Dissemblian way of describing.
It was a bit Partridge, wasn't it?
A prostitute ever. Escort lady.
I didn't know quite. I was sort of halfway through that. I really sound like Alan Partridge here.
No, you sounded
John Teal.
Lovely.
It was pure and innocent.
It was.
Yeah. Okay.
We love you, Phil.
Thanks, Terry.
I'm telling Mum.
Don't bring Mum into it.
So this brings us to Boss Baby. Now, disclaimer, we haven't seen Boss Baby, any of us, in this room. We have seen it as a magazine, so I can paraphrase our thoughts, which are not massively complimentary. Apparently, this thing cost $125 million to make, which is amazing. Yeah.
$125 million? Are you serious?
Apparently, yeah. That's,
how much did they pay Alec Baldwin?
It's hard to say. It has already made that money back. It's actually been quite a big hit in America. So the story is basically there is a family. The parents are voiced by Lisa Kudrow and Jimmy Kimmel. They have a young son, and a new baby turns up. And basically the whole movie is the older son's sort of fantasy of this baby coming and taking over the whole house, and it's got a suit, and he's yelling and trying to do a corporate takeover of the house. And yeah, apparently it's very hyperactive and not massively funny. But it has got Alec Baldwin just yelling for 95 minutes or whatever it is. So,
I was excited by that. Just Alec Baldwin. I was like, Alec Baldwin shouting, Jimmy Kimmel. Like, it sounds like it should.
It sounds like it should be fun.
Yeah.
More fun than it is. Apparently. I just have to say apparently at the end of every sentence because I've not seen it. But, you know, I'm disappointed because I was kind of intrigued by it as well. I like Alec Baldwin. And, he's pretty good at yelling.
He is. Do you think if we paid him, he'd just come into the office and yell at us?
That would be awesome.
Yeah, we haven't got $125 million, but we've got, like, some donuts. Got some donuts, and I've got some shrapnel under my chair. Would you like to come in and yell at us? That's an official offer, by the way, from Empire.
This is amazing. You're like his character in Glengarry Glen Ross. Always be closing. You win the steak knife or whatever. But yeah, come to the office, seriously, Alec, and we'll have fun.
Shout at us.
Yell at us.
Yell at us. Louder.
Yep.
It's like it's already happening.
So there we go. That is our thoughts on Boss Baby.
Do you think Hollywood's just going to make animations in due course? Because they seem to make like colossal amounts of money pretty much across the board.
They seem to cost colossal amounts of money.
Well, yeah, there's that too.
Hard to say.
I don't think so. I mean, there were no animation in the top. Just thinking about the top five films at the UK box office last year.
No.
No animations.
No. But in the US, they seem to just go gangbusters, like Zootopia. Secret Life of Pets last year. But they just seem like franchise spawners, I guess, is the thing. But... don't know. $125 million. I can't wrap my head around that.
Yeah.
How is that possible?
According to the internet, if that's not true. Yeah. Sorry, okay. blame it on the internet.
You could make like 84 of your art house movies for that, Phil.
You could make way more than that.
You could make 184 of your art house movies for that,
I'd like to make one art house movie for that and just make it epic.
But then it wouldn't be an art house movie.
Yeah, it would. It'd just be a blockbuster art house movie.
You could get all of the set in a village.
Set in a small peasant village in space.
Whoa.
Yeah.
I'd watch it.
And it's just about the people.
You could get the Dardenne brothers and the Duplass brothers.
Together.
For some kind of mega blowout.
Yeah. And us.
Yeah.
Not what we'd bring to it, though.
Be a lot of improv. Yeah. But, yeah. I'm very curious to see how Cars 3 does later this year.
Yes.
Very curious indeed. Because they're weirdly successful.
Yeah. Yeah, people love successful. The Cars movies. Also out this week is James Baldwin documentary I'm Not Your Negro, which got 4 stars. Zach Braff's Going in Style with Morgan Freeman and Michael Caine, that got 2 stars. An Arnie revenge drama, Aftermath, we gave that 4. And a pair of biopics about poets, bizarrely. We gave 3 stars to Terence Davis's A Quiet Passion, which had Cynthia Dixon playing American poet Emily Dickinson, and 4 stars for Pablo Larraín's follow-up to Jackie, Neruda, about the Chilean poet Pablo Neruda. Until then, it's goodbye from Terry.
Goodbye from Terry.
It's goodbye from Nick.
Goodbye from Nick.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to wage war against a giant crab with a shotgun. See you next week.